Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 191 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have three cases today, one's from the Seventh Circuit, one's from the Illinois Supreme Court, and we have a pair from the Supreme Court of the United States dealing with the Chevron Doctrine and its future. The first case today is from the Illinois Supreme Court, Triplex Technical Services.
Or does it have one?
Yeah. Supreme Court Triplex Technical Services Limited versus John Donne LLC. The second is from the Seventh Circuit, Economic Loss Plaintiffs versus Abbott Laboratories. And the third is a pair of cases at the Supreme Court, Relentless Inc. versus Department of Commerce and Loper Bright Enterprises Inc. versus Raimondo, Secretary of Commerce. Turning to our first case, what is the remedy for a business competitor using more than the statutorily allowed amount of the active ingredient in a cleaning solution? Can the allegedly damaged party bring an action under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act and the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act, or are those actions left to the state of Illinois? If such an action could be brought, how would the plaintiff calculate the damages? Those are among the questions to be answered when the Illinois Supreme Court decides Triplex Technical Services Limited versus John Donne LLC, which was argued recently. The circuit court dismissed the plaintiff's complaint and the appellate court reversed. Pat, tell us about this case.
Dan, this is not the first time we've talked about this case. We talked about this case in the appellate court.
Correct.
Let's just say that you've got very good appellate advocates in this case on both sides. If memory serves, Joel Pertocchi has the defendants. Joel is the former Solicitor General of the state of Illinois. He's at Ackerman. He's was at Hinshaw. I had a case with him when he was at Hinshaw and then at Ackerman. Former district judge Ruben Castillo at Ackerman is on the brief. And I'm trying to remember who's on the plaintiff's side, but it's no slouch. It's someone else that's very good. I'm sorry, I can't remember their name. But
I'm drawing a blank as well.
It's a big case. And it's a big case because because of what it's at stake, not just in this case, but in other kinds of cases. We talked about in the context of the Supreme Court of the United States, Chief Justice Roberts mentioned or used a phrase a couple years ago in an oral argument, the freewheeling days of I think the 60s and 70s, where they were implying rights of action and this kind of a thing. And he's contrasted that with the more textual approach that the court takes now, that they don't imply rights of action where they aren't there. And Illinois, I'm not sure whether we're in the freewheeling or the textual, probably somewhere in between. I think it would be a fair assessment of where Illinois courts are at on this idea.
I think that's right.
We've talked about implied rights of action. I think we talked about it in a case involving where an employer had a life insurance policy on an employee, she wasn't just an employee, she was the CEO, and requiring her, and there are restrictions on that, whether she could bring a right of action, and the court held you couldn't do that, but she had other actions for retaliatory discharge that she could bring if memory serves. So this kind of a thing exists. As I say, I think Illinois courts are tending more towards textual application and less towards implying rights of action, where the General Assembly hasn't specifically said that the right of action exists. And that's the case here. Is who's in the best position to do this. And the question becomes, okay, even if you don't apply the right of action, is it an unfair business practice to use stronger ingredients, more of the active ingredient than what is allowed, to the detriment of your competitors. And I get the point of the plaintiffs, assuming their allegations are true. I don't know if they're true, but let's assume they are for the purposes of this discussion, as the court must assume that they're true for the purposes of a motion to dismiss, that the defendants are using more of this active ingredient, volatile organic compounds and high phosphorus, because apparently that makes things clean better. And the plaintiff says, hey, we're following the rules and these guys aren't. And as a result, their products do a better job than ours, because of course they do. But they're also violative of state statute, and state statute gives to, I think it's the Illinois EPA, the authority to regulate the amount of these volatile compounds and these phosphorus and these ingredients. And you can understand why you might, if these are dangerous chemicals. I don't know what the particular dangers are of these chemicals, but let's assume that they are dangerous, and there could be runoff that goes into the water and harms the waterways, the fishes, and so forth, but also could harm humans, perhaps. I don't know what the particular risks are. Sorry, not a carpet cleaner, but I'm told by listening to this oral argument that carpet cleaning solutions that have more of this stuff work better. And also you can imagine the environmental impacts. So who gets to sue? And one of the justices, was it Justice Overstreet? I think who asked, okay, that's great, but how are you ever going to calculate your damages? How are you ever going to show that you lost these profits, or what profits you would have made if they had sold their products in conformity with the law? Now, I think plaintiff's counsel quite rightly pointed out, well, that's not the issue. If we fail on evidence, we'll fail on evidence, and we'll get to that point there. But let's deal with one step at a time. And our case got kicked by the circuit court on us not being able to state a cause of action in the first instance, because we were essentially doing private attorney general stuff, what amounts to that, which raises the question, what the attorney general has done with this? Why haven't they? I don't think they came in. I don't think they took over the action. I don't think they filed an amicus, from what I could tell. Why aren't they enforcing this if this is a violation? I don't know. And maybe the plaintiff's just wrong. Again, I don't know. Maybe the plaintiff's right. Let's, as I said, for the purpose of this discussion, let's assume they're right, because that's what they've alleged. And so this has a potential spillover effect if the court implies a right of action to other, not just in this very narrow cleaning solution statute, but other similar statutes. Because once you go down the road, once the court goes down the road of implying rights of action in one set of situations, you can be sure that other enterprising lawyers are going to look at other similarly written statutes and say, well, you did it over here, you got to do it here. And if there isn't a limiting principle, then that's what's going to happen in all likelihood. So maybe that's what the legislature intended. Maybe it isn't. I would certainly take the position that if they didn't write it, that there's a private right of action, that there isn't. And I think that the courts have done that in most contexts to say that there isn't. But we'll see what happens. An important and interesting case, anytime you're talking about implying rights of action, where the General Assembly has legislated, because there's something that unlike Congress, the Illinois General Assembly is very capable of getting things done, and very capable of writing statutes that regulate all kinds of things, for better or for worse. They can write them. One need only look at, this is not in the civil context, but in the criminal context, the Safety Act is what, 700 some pages. Congress seems to save its 700 page bills for omnibus budget packages. In Illinois, we have them for all kinds of regulations, civil and criminal. And they're certainly capable of doing that. Or they can do it in very short words and cause all kinds of headaches like BIPA. Then that'd be very long to cause all kinds of problems. So they're very capable of regulating when they want to, and specifying when there's a private right of action, for example, in BIPA, where they specifically said there's a private right of action, and here's how you make it out. So I I'm not sure I understand the plaintiff's position here. I do understand their point that they that this may be an unfair, deceptive trade practice. I have no idea how they would prove it, but that isn't the issue at this stage. Dan, what are your thoughts?
Pat, you're absolutely right, and you mentioned BIPA.
Absolutely right. Well,
yeah,
that's good.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You mentioned BIPA, and there's some reform legislation pending. There was last legislative session as well, and we've talked about, you know, the one thing with the Illinois legislature that often is the case is they know how to do legislation. They've got excellent staff. Justice David Ellis was the senior counsel for Michael Madigan for years, and they really look at legislation. They have excellent the Legislative Bureau or whatever it's called down in Springfield. I forget the exact name.
LRB, Legislative Research Bureau. Rumor has it, in my understanding, is that it's not nearly as well staffed, and not in terms of quantity. I don't know about the quality, but in terms of they're overworked. They don't have enough staff right now. Things have changed substantially since Madigan was running things, for good or for ill. There was a certain order to how things worked when Madigan was in charge. And now it's a bit chaotic. And one of the products of that chaos is there are tons of more bills than there used to be.
Yes. Yes. For better or worse, Madigan was, when my oldest was in eighth grade, we went down and visited Springfield and got a personal visit with him, which many people hadn't done in years. And, he talked about that process of how he was a gatekeeper and a very strong one. And for better or worse, that's what happened back in those days. But in any event, they have excellent writers down there. Like you said, they can address this. They could address whether there's a private right of action. They could address whether there's different standards and who enforces this provision. Like you said, the challenge, I think, when we talked about this case previously and now is even if you go forward and you can prove some unfair trade practice, like you said, how do you prove that it's just on a superior product, even if they came within the limits? You know, and again, I'm not an expert on this stuff. My dad, back in the late 1970s, had a side gig with another police officer where they cleaned carpets and floors in commercial buildings. And, you know, I have no idea what chemicals or anything they used or what brands, but... an interesting case, and like you said, I think this case is bigger than just this case because, you know, one thing that this could lead to if the plaintiffs win here is you'd try to reverse engineer almost any product that has some kind of limitation on whatever active ingredient is, right? Whether it's pharmaceuticals or anything else, and then you would be able to pursue these cases and. It'll be an interesting case to see what the Illinois Supreme Court does. And I think it was Overstreet. You mentioned you thought it was Overstreet. I think it was Overstreet that was asking those questions. So in any event, we'll see what the Supreme Court does with this.
There's only so many male justices on the Illinois Supreme Court right now. So.
There are.
And one with an accent.
Right.
So it's usually easy to pick out.
It is. It is. So... in any event, and that may change or may not. There's, I know Justice Cunningham's up against Justice Reyes, so we'll see what that race does. And I think April or whenever it is.
No, March 19th
March.
Is the primary.
Okay.
March 19th is the primary, and you'll surely be able to tell the difference between Justice Reyes if Justice Reyes were to win, between Justice Reyes's voice and Justice Cunningham's voice.
Right.
They sound much different.
They do.
So. We'll see what happens there, but early voting is open, so it's okay to vote early, just not often in Cook County.
Right.
Vote early, not often. All right, we'll take our first break, and we'll come back with economic loss plaintiffs versus Abbott Laboratories. What a name for a case.
Right.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment two of episode 191 of the Podium and Panel podcast. The Seventh Circuit gets to take up its hobby horse of standing again. In this case, plaintiffs purchased powdered infant formula products manufactured at a facility in Sturgis, Michigan that were subsequently recalled. That's Sturgis, Michigan, not Sturgis, South Dakota. So right. It wasn't that it was made by a bunch of bikers. It was because there was some contamination or something in this facility. So it wasn't a converted meth lab. It just was a facility. This was around the, if you recall, during the pandemic, there was a shortage of baby formula, not related to the pandemic, but related to this facility. And there were problems with, I forget what the particular problem was, but it was alleged contamination. Fortunately, I didn't have a child of age that needed such product, but I knew parents who did, and it was a big problem. The district court dismissed a class in the MDL, that's multi-district litigation, of economic loss plaintiffs, and this appeal followed. On appeal, the questions presented are, one, did the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois err when it held that the plaintiff appellant's economic loss claims of overpayment for defendant appellees' premium-priced name-brand products are, quote, too speculative, end quote, to establish Article III standing despite multiple Food and Drug Administration documents, a whistleblower complaint, the product recall, and an FDA-mandated shutdown of the Sturgis facility as cited in plaintiff's appellant's amended class action complaint, which collectively create the reasonable inference that class products, including plaintiff appellants purchased recalled products, which could not be used per FDA direction, were unsafe for consumption and therefore valueless or at best of diminished value. That's a run-on sentence.
It is a bit.
Question two.
Another run-on.
Question two. Did the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois err when it found that Article 3 requires plaintiff appellants to allege the exact percentages of contaminant products or to allege the risk of, quote, latent, end quote, physical injury in order to have standing to pursue their plausible allegations that they suffered a financial injury when they paid a premium purchase price for defendant appellee's name brand products, including recalled products, which they would not have otherwise paid for, but for defendant appellee's misrepresentations about its unhygienic production practices. Dan, I got to take a break. Tell us about that case.
Thanks, Pat. And it was an interesting argument for the Seventh Circuit. Let's just say the appellant didn't have a very easy day of it. This panel was all over it. And the argument here is a couple things that are embedded in those run-on sentences, the two issues on appeal. One is that Abbott, for its baby
formula. And I say run-on sentences as a big fan of writing run-on sentences and having to go back and split up my sentences, sometimes into and four sentences. So
right.
I like to string ideas together. I get it, but that's a bit much even for me.
Those were long sentences. That was... And again, going back to Illinois, sometimes legislation has paragraphs like that in it in Illinois, and talk about being hard to bifurcate the sentence and figure out what the hell is actually being said. But in any event, one of the arguments here is that Abbott charges a 50% premium over its competitors. We talked about competitors in the last one with the formulas and the using more active ingredients than allowed. In this case, it's just that Abbott... perceptionally in the market or whatever, creates a superior product to the other products, to the generics, and charges a 50% premium. So that's one of the things that the appellant was arguing here. The further argument that she's making is that because these products at the Sturgis plant had some form of contaminant that's under FDA rules, that these products were illegal. And so that the very nature of selling these things, that there's injury, in fact, by the purchase price. And again, let's just say that the panel at the Seventh Circuit was not fully buying what she was selling. They said, you're kind of all over the place. You're bouncing in your arguments. I think one of the interesting things, Pat, was when the appellee got up to speak, the advocate for the appellee, he mentioned that we're hearing new arguments at the podium for the first time. And one of the arguments she made was that there's a consent decree here. What happens in any thing, and we'll talk about regulatory and administrative agencies in the next segment in the Chevron doctrine, but what happens in these cases is that, for example, in privacy context, the Federal Trade Commission often enters into consent decrees with those that they find to have violated the Federal Trade Act. And here, the Abbott Labs entered into some form of consent decree. And there's a paragraph 99 in the complaint that alleges somehow, again, that Abbott admitted that they had, in fact, issued contaminants. One of the judges, when the appellee talked about these new arguments at the deponent and this consent decree that allegedly said that all the products that they issued were illegal or all had contaminants, was that that would be a weird thing to admit. The other thing that was here, Pat, was there was an 11th Circuit case that was a very different facts, and the appellee talked about that case and how the analogy failed. I'm drawing a blank on the exacts, but it was not similar to this. Again, what the appellant's arguing here is that it's almost like a defamation per se. This was almost what she's alleging that this is was illegal per se to even issue any of these products to the public market, and that people were, and she said, you know, plaintiffs may not be able to show actual damages because, again, this is the standing issue, Pat, that we talk about repeatedly with the Seventh Circuit. We've talked about it in the BIPA context. We've talked about it in all kinds of contexts.
FDCPA.
These statutory damages regimes of alphabet letters that Easterbrook doesn't like to use. And again, the judges, when the appellant spoke, just were not really, to me, weren't buying this argument that by the very nature of issuing these products, and what's the injury here? How is someone injured? They got rebates or refunds on these products. There was a recall that went out. If you followed the recall, you would get your money back. And like you said in the first question, the issue is whether or not, or the second question, the second issue on appeal here, is one of the questions from the judges was, what if the chance of getting sick from this product was 1 in a billion? Is everybody that was issued this product, do they all have a claim to make against the company? And I think they were a little bit concerned about how broad of an issue this would be. And the analogy on rebuttal that the one judge used is if you go to a restaurant and it turns out that there's some bad food that was issued and people get sick, but you weren't sick. Do you have a cause of action? Is there an actual injury that you can go against the restaurant on? I think the final plea or request of appellant counsel was that they should send this back. And again, paragraph 99 of the complaint, it doesn't sound like it was very well articulated. It's a very long complaint. Obviously, if you got 99 paragraphs and there were many more paragraphs. And she asked, at least for a chance, she asked that the court not shut the doors on this issue. I think the interesting thing, Pat, is if they did agree with the appellant here, the appellee talked that there would be a circuit split because two other circuits have ruled that this is not something that the plaintiffs can pursue as a class because there's no actual stated injury. So I don't think that will happen, but if it did, it would be interesting to see if there would be some interest in the Supreme Court in taking this case on.
Yeah, I don't see the Supreme Court taking this case.
No.
I think the Seventh Circuit's going to be in line with the other circuits. They're certainly the most hawkish of the circuit. I mean, if not the most hawkish, amongst the most hawkish. I don't want to short shrift any other circuits that I'm not nearly as familiar with. being hawks on this kind of an issue. But I don't see a circuit split coming, and I don't see the concept that there's going to be that they're going to find standing here. There's little to no chance they're going to find standing, and that's going to be dispositive of this case, or at least this part.
I think so.
With that, Dan, we'll take our next break and come back with Chevron, which we'll see how much longer it has. Late June, early July, maybe not so much.
I think it's done.
Yeah, we'll see.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of the Podium and Panel Podcast, episode 191. The most powerful branch of government is not one you will find in the Constitution or in Schoolhouse Rock, or at least it's not segregated as such. It's the administrative agencies, which technically fall under the executive branch for the most part. SCOTUS heard argument in two cases, Relentless Inc. versus Department of Commerce and Loper Bright Enterprises Inc. versus Raimondo, Secretary of Commerce, challenging the Chevron doctrine recently. Oye summarized the Loper Bright thusly, quote, a group of commercial fishermen who regularly participate in the Atlantic carrying fishery sued the National Marine Fisheries Service after the service promulgated a rule that required industry to fund at-sea monitoring programs at an estimated cost of $710 per day. The fishermen argued that the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act of 1976 did not authorize the service to create industry-funded monitoring requirements and that the service failed to follow proper rulemaking procedure. The district court granted summary judgment for the government based on its reasonable interpretation of its authority and its adoption of the rule through the required notice and comment procedure. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit affirmed. Oye summarized Relentless Inc. versus Department of Commerce as follows, quote, the Atlantic carrying fishery is regulated by the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act aimed at preventing overfishing and promoting conservation. And the MSA sets up regional councils, including the New England Fishery Management Council, which oversees the Atlantic carrying fishery. These councils create fishery management plans to set conservation measures, which must align with 10 national standards and other laws. The Secretary of Commerce, through the National Marine Fisheries Services, reviews and publishes these plans for public comment. In 2000, the New England Council established an FMP for Atlantic herring, updated with an industry-funded monitoring program in 2020. The program partially shifts the cost of at-sea monitoring to vessel owners, but aims for a 50% target of monitored herring trips, which will cause reduced profits for the fishing industry and communities. Owners of two fishing vessels, Relentless Inc., Huntress Inc., and Seafreeze Fleet LLC, challenged the rule, arguing that the monitoring requirement disproportionately burdens them because of their longer trips and inability to qualify for exemptions. The district court granted summary judgment in favor of the agency, ruling that the MSA's ambiguity on industry-paid monitors allows for agency interpretation under Chevron deference, that the rule complies with the MSA's national standards and the Regulatory Flexibility Act, and does not violate the Commerce Clause. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit affirmed, end quote. Pat, tell us about these interesting cases.
Thanks, Dan. I think it's important. We don't talk about Chevron that much on the show. I think we may have referred to it a couple times, but I think it's helpful to kind of set it up. So the Chevron case is Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council from 1984. And it's probably one of the most important decisions of the 20th century, especially given the size and scope of the administrative state. And what it says is that where the statute is ambiguous, if the government offers a reasonable interpretation in its rulemaking of that statute, then the court is to give deference to that interpretation by the government and to rule in its favor. Now, there are numerous other doctrines as well. There's Auer deference, which was an issue in the recent Kaiser case that we probably discussed on the, and that's a case where the agency's interpretation of its own rules, if those are ambiguous, then the deference is given to the agency. That's what Auer deference is. And there's other deference doctrines. But Chevron's the big one. And Chevron's the big one for a variety of reasons. Now, you may notice, and if you know Dan and I, you'll know that I wrote the beginning of the introduction and Dan modified it slightly and not inappropriately. I know that the administrative state is not a branch, but it right. is, because you can't remove them. They're like that. You can't remove them for damn near anything.
You can remove the chiefs, secretaries,
yes, but you can't. No, but it's the people that are actually writing these rules. They're the political officers, sure, at the very right. top. But under that, the people that are writing these rules, the executive, the political appointees, and the president, essentially have no authority to do anything to these people. They're immune, and so their career. I don't want to use the term bureaucrats because that has a pejorative sense to it. But their career is in this department doing these things. And in some cases, they're exercising particular expertise as to what is necessary, in this case, to the management of fisheries. The Atlantic fishery is amongst the most productive in the world. The herring is very important for a variety of reasons to other fish, you know, on the food chain. Also, humans, for some reason, like to consume them. And so... It's a very important resource. And the problem with, we get all kinds of issues regarding the management of the oceans being a tragedy to the commons because no one owns it and therefore it gets overfished. And this is what the goal of this is, to try to prevent that. So what you have is these folks that aren't politically accountable necessarily. And so they're being deferred to. And the one of the criticisms among many of Chevron is that it places a finger, if not a brick, on the scale in favor of one of the parties. It's supposed to be that the parties come to the court in an equal footing. That is, and the court is to apply the law equally to them. Well, in Chevron, if the court finds the statute ambiguous, then the parties are not equal. It's required to rule in favor of one or the other. Now, that's different, you know, in the insurance context. You have an ambiguity. What do you have? An ambiguity in insurance policy. It's construed against, or the more broad grant of coverage under the two reasonable interpretations is granted in favor of the insured, because the defendant or the insurance company, whether the defendant or plaintiff, the insurance company wrote the policy. And that's a well-settled doctrine of contract law generally, and specifically with respect to and applied to contract law. Or, I'm sorry, insurance law. But this is a bit different. This is the Congress writes the statute. The government then, through the executive branch, issues a rule trying to enforce that. And they're independent, essentially. The citizen, in this case, the fisherman, and the administrative agency that wrote the rules that said they had to pay. And it's the position of the fisherman that you can't make us pay because it's not in the statute. And it's the position of the government that, oh, yes, we can, because it's kind of there. And if you squint hard enough, you can see it. The court said, well, the squinting is reasonable, so you can make them charge it. Now, the reason why this is a big problem for the fisherman's perspective is their margins on herring are very thin. These trips are long. The work is dangerous. They don't have space on these boats. And you're going to make us pay up for them on top of it at $700 a day. It cuts substantially into our profits, which is why they end up hiring. Make sure I got Paul Clement had one of them, and I forget who the advocate who had the other. Needless to say, on the other side, because of the importance of the issue, was Solicitor General herself, Prelogger, who yep. did double duty, and damn, is she good at her job. She's really good, because these arguments between the two of them went on for what, 3 hours?
More than three. Yeah, three and a half.
One was two change. The other was an hour. The second one was an hour, and that's the one that Clement was on, and he was great as always. And pre-law, but the arguments are slightly different in the two cases, and she's bobbing and weaving between the two, and a variety of opinions are out there on the court. So you have justices like Kagan, Sotomayor, Jackson, who are down with Chevron. And then on the conservative side of the court, it's like herding cats, because you've got a general dislike of it, but for different reasons, and all, what they're really searching for, what do we do next? If we undo this, what do we do? So Gorsuch, long critic of Chevron, both on the circuit court, I think even in prior writings and on the court itself, wants to do Skidmore, which is really no standard at all. It's not really anything. I'm not sure why he favors that, but that seems to be what his favorite is. He's on Kavanaugh, who sat on the DC circuit, the court that probably hears the most of these kinds of challenges because of where it's at, is not a fan, but it was unclear where he wanted to go next. Then you have, you had a lot of criticism of the Brand X decision. And the Brand X decision was a case that says that, and this is what you have in many of these cases, where Republican administration does X, Democrat administration does not X, Republican administration does X again, and Democrat administration does not X again. And this flip kind of flip-flopping occurs across the administrative state. And it occurs across the in all manner of cases. It's Republicans changing what Democrats did, and Democrats changing what Republicans did. I mean, the example I gave started with a Republican doing something, Democrats reversing it. But it's both ways. It doesn't matter. And with Justice Thomas sitting right there, they're criticizing his opinion in Brand X, a decision that I think he wishes he hadn't written at this point, because let's just say it's not very old, but it hasn't aged well. And so it hasn't aged well. And so what do you do with that? You're going to see a lot of cases get overturned, I think. And what do you do with the cases where this is one that came up quite a bit? Is if you have a party that won on Chevron deference, are those decisions stare decisis, or are they able to be upset? And obviously, that is a big point in the favor of following stare decisis. If you're going to upset 70 some or however many decisions it was, and the position of both the advocates for petitioners as well as the justices that seem to be in favor of getting rid of Chevron, said, no, those are stare decisis. You're not upsetting those. It's only on a going forward basis, which I understand why you have to say that. I don't know if the intellectual consistency in that particular regard, but then what the hell else are you going to say?
Right.
That's the long windup. Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, a lot to say on this, Pat. The original Chevron was the Clean Water Act, and again, you can talk about ambiguities and stuff, but that act was pretty clear, and most of these challenges are under the Clean Water Act. The last term, they found that there was ambiguities and kind of chipped away at this. The thing that listeners should know is that the conservatives, the originalists, the textualists, Scalia especially, was enamored and loved this thing. It was 2 years before he got on the bench, and he loved Chevron. And Rehnquist did not participate in Chevron for some reason. I think because he was Department of Justice and whatever. He did not participate. Sandra Day O'Connor did not participate. It was a 6-0 decision back then. And
it wouldn't have mattered if they had.
Nah. Stevens wrote the opinion, Justice John Paul Stevens from Seventh Circuit, that went to the bench. And, You know, the thing is that Roberts seemed to suggest that little would change. I mean, the reality is, Pat, that even back in the day, when you look at the Attorney General's office and things that were created, they didn't have much to go on. And, you know, we talk about that as a bloated administrative state now. The other thing I think that our friend Adam Feldman wrote about, and is a real issue here, is that Congress back in the 1970s and stuff, when Chevron became the issue, knew how to legislate and act. And I don't think, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, we have a dysfunctional Congress. And are they up to the task of being able to write rules, let alone legislation? I mean, what legislation's passed in the last 10 years of significance? A tax reform act, but that's not really, it didn't create an agency. It didn't give agencies, you know what I mean? So I think the big challenge here is exactly that. When I wrote about this in right after it happened, I you know, Alito may write for this, and I said there's a passage, Perlogar, she said ambiguity exists when the court has exhausted the tools of interpretation and hasn't been able to arrive at confidence that there's a right answer that Congress spoke to the issue. And Alito said, well, as Justice Kavanaugh's recent question presented, in cases that don't involve an agency, we never say we've exhausted all of our tools of interpretation and we just can't figure out what this means. So that would seem to suggest you never get to step two. And so it'll be an interesting case. I think the reality is that in some form or fashion, Chevron is gone. What that means for, like you said, the 77 or whatever other precedents, we'll see. But the reality is that the administrative state continues. And Pat, you know, one argument that this actually at least works in theory is what you talked about, is when administrations come in, when there's a Republican administration, the EEOC, the National Labor Relations Board, the EPA, the Department of Education, they constrict what they do. And underlings or not, when you're DeJoy at the Postal Service or you're Perry or whatever at another agency, you kind of control what comes out of that agency, right, in terms of papers and positions and how you approach things. So it's an issue. And then add to all this, Pat, the decision that will be coming in the Trump case of whether he's an officer for 14 amendment purposes, but other purposes as well. If the president's not an officer, then who the hell's in charge of these agencies, which report to the executive branch? So a lot of things going here, and I think we'll know on the Trump case, I think fairly recent, soon, but we have to, but we haven't seen it yet. I mean, they got 2 weeks left to get that out.
They got to issue an opinion before Super Tuesday.
Probably this weekend, right? Or this week, or the week after. I mean, that's it. They got 2 weeks.
It has to be before Super Tuesday.
So you got a lot of issues here, but yeah, I think, I mean, I don't think there's anybody out there that's saying that there's a hope of Chevron surviving. You know, Perlogar, you know, argued and asked for a narrow ruling if they go against it. And again, we may see that. We've seen that in some other contexts that we've talked about in the show and otherwise, but I don't see that here because, like you said, there's enough people, I think, Gorsuch for sure, Kavanaugh for sure, Thomas for sure, and Alito that want this to just be resolved fully. Gorsuch, I don't know if listeners know, but his mom worked for the Department of Education and was removed.
No. She was the director EOC? Of the EPA. No, she EPA. Was the commissioner of the EPA when Chevron was decided.
That's right.
She was the commissioner of the EPA under Reagan.
And she was removed for some reason. And so in any event,
yes.
That may be part of his hating the administrative state. But in any event, interesting case coming up, and we'll see what the court does by June.
So apropos of Brand X and the flip-flopping and all of this is one of my favorite lines from The Federalist. Federalist 62 about the Senate. You remember the Senate, you know, keeps things in place. So I will quote, "Another effect of public instability is the unreasonable advantage it gives to the sagacious, the enterprising, and the moneyed few over the industrious and uninformed masses of the people. Every new regulation concerning commerce or revenue in any way affecting the value of the different species of property presents a new harvest to those who watch the change and can trace its consequences, a harvest reared not by themselves but by the tolls and cares of the great body of the fellow citizens. This is a state of things in which it may be said that some truth that the laws are made by the few, not for the many. Made for the few, not by the many. Yeah. And this idea that you have it constantly changing, and when they refer to the sagacious, the enterprising, and the moneyed few, the term we have for it now is called regulatory capture. And those are the sagacious, the enterprising, and the moneyed few.
Well, you could also say that those sagacious and the moneyed few are the nonprofit organizations run by Leonard Leo and other ones that fund all the litigation that's before the Supreme Court on all these topics. Whether it's, you know, that there are a few groups that are the moneyed few that are spending billions to in the last decade with this court to change how law is. So I'm not so sure there's flip flops anymore, because again, there is this argument, and I think again you talk about different. You know, there's one of the reasons that Chevron was so well loved was Reagan was in charge when it went into effect, and then H.W. Bush, and then it wasn't, because then it became Bill Clinton, and oh my God, he was doing things that some people didn't like, and then when the next Republican president got in, Trump, again, there was some deference to his actions on the borders and other things. So again, you know, I think this argument is one that's, you know, but you're right. It's and it is a bloated state, and you know, there's people like Miller Leonard and others on LinkedIn that talk about it in the criminal context and other contexts. Again, It's just one of these issues that, you know, who knows what the solution is or what this looks like in 10 years.
Indeed. So it'll be very interesting to see what they do, how broad or narrow an opinion that they issue. And that's really what this is about. So that brings us to BIPA, BI, GIPA, and IPA. big news. The New York Court of Appeals, that is the Supreme Court of the state of New York, called the Court of Appeals because New York does New York things.
Yeah.
They upheld a win for Westport Insurance Company. We also heard, and I believe this to be the case, that they have set oral argument in early March in California.
That's right.
On their BI case. So New York, you know, the big five states in insurance are New York, Illinois, California, Texas, and Florida. And notably, Illinois has ruled by default because the Illinois Supreme Court hasn't ruled.
Right.
Florida, to my knowledge, hasn't ruled. Texas hasn't ruled. But there aren't many cases percolating in those places.
No.
The big places where courts had, you would lose there. So they didn't pursue them there. They sued them in California, Washington, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, places where you thought if you were
a Massachusetts, Connecticut, Washington.
Where you thought you might do better.
Right.
So they haven't. And they haven't, as it turns out. We'll see what happens in California. California is the big one. We'll see what happens there.
Yeah.
So this week, on Prediction Sure to Go Wrong, we were 1-1. Dan is 291.5, 61.5, and 21. I am 288.5, 64.5, and 21. We got Coatney versus Ancestry.com wrong that we discussed on episode 181. That was from the Seventh Circuit. Dan, why don't you tell us about Coatney?
This was a case where, for whatever reason, folks were sending for their minor kids, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, the information about their, you know, about their genetics, and who knows for what reason or why, but as we've talked about, minors can't contract. So these contracts talked about arbitration of disputes, and Ancestry.com said that these minors were bound to arbitrate their claims between their guardians and Ancestry. The district court disagreed, and the appellate court affirmed that decision and said, no, they're not bound, and we got this one wrong because we thought for sure, because these were minors, that they would be subject to the arbitration provisions that their guardians signed on to since they can't contract. But lo and behold, no.
So Dan, I'm gonna, I sent you this quote from the opinion last evening. And I'm going to put you on your hobby horse, since we talked about hobby horses earlier. I'm going to let you go. We know we disagree on this, but this is hilarious. I can't get this go. Quote, though a special relationship exists between plaintiffs and their guardians. The plaintiffs are the minor children of the parents.
Right.
A special relationship. Okay. Yeah.
I hope so.
In fact, and in law, that relationship does not join their identities. A minor child, I get to make all the decisions, as it turns out. My daughter's mother and I get to make all the decisions. She and I have a dispute, then the people in black robes get involved. But assuming we agree, that's what's going to happen. If she gets sick, God forbid, we decide what happens. Nobody else, the two of us, that's how this works. Okay. So in fact, in a law, that relationship does not join their identities. And as can be the case with parent and subsidiary corporations. Further, neither plaintiffs nor their guardians negotiated the terms. Indeed, there is no evidence plaintiffs even knew the terms. So I want to get this straight. The parent corporation has a greater relationship with the subsidiary organization than does the parent to the child. Dan, the floor is yours.
I don't know that this is my hobby horse. I mean, I...
Well, no, it's Citizens United on steroids.
Well, it is. It's astounding to me that a non-entity that's a person for constitutional purposes, like you said.
Well, I understand why they're a person for constitutional purposes, because of the association.
No, I do too.
Not in this context.
But to more control. But yeah. I mean, it's you know, the one thing I mentioned the other day when I did the CBA insurance law committee, we talked about BIPA and some other, and GIPA and some other things, and minors, is that there's a law that's in the federal books called the Children Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, which is this horrible acronym, COPPA feel, but in any event, a terrible, terrible acronym. But it says that for purposes of online access, an adult is the age of 13. Let that sink in. Some lobbyist. Yeah, it's my oldest son had a dispute with Facebook at one point when he was about 14 or 15, and I wrote saying, you know, he's trying to figure this out. And they said, he has to call us, you have no rights. And I said, you know, just let you know that if anything happens to him, if there's online predators, if there's something that he gets involved in, if he's bullied and does something, I'm coming after you. I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. But in this case, I have a hard time understanding. Like you said, my kids, when they were minors, we made decisions. If they needed medical treatment, if they were going to go to the church, if they were, you know, what schools they attended, if that was our decisions.
Well,
as parents,
religious training and so forth. Right? That's your choice as parents.
And so to say that because the kids weren't aware of the contracts, well then, you know, I just don't get it. Like the thing that comes to mind for me, Pat, is car insurance. Like, you know, they may not understand that I've got car insurance on them that costs me an extra $5,000 a year or whatever because they're knucklehead teenage boys. But again, they get an accident or something, is that going to be the position? Well, they don't know the terms. They're not subject to this contract.
They don't have to cooperate all of a sudden to the policy of insurance. Come on, give me a break.
It just is really, this blows me away. Honestly, I don't know how we got this wrong. That language you read is the wildest thing I've heard in a long time.
It is wild. All right. Speaking of wild, one we got right, but I think we wish we hadn't, at least me. Wilcox versus Advocate Condell, episode 188, is where we discussed the oral argument. An extraordinarily long opinion, 40-some pages, in minute detail as to the care of this person, or lack of it, as the case may be, and it's a very good discussion of institutional negligence, and frankly, what it is, it's a legal theory of a failure of a system of safety rules and all the rest. This is very well done reptile tactics. This is very well done, you know, protecting the community, but done in a way that got past the gatekeeper, that you know, they had established that the duty existed because they didn't have a duty question here because he's in the hospital. So the question becomes, was there a breach, and was that, did that breach cause injury? And the court held both, that there was a breach and that it caused injury. So a very interesting case, a tragic circumstance, massive breakdown in the care that was provided, whether it was the doctor's fault, as the hospital claimed, or whether it was, as the jury found and the appellate court affirmed, a systems failure as claimed by the plaintiffs. So far, at least, I expect there'll be a PLA given the $40-some million verdict. Whether that's granted or not, I don't know, but it will be interesting. Dan, thoughts on this case?
I agree, Pat. I think I'm the same view. I wish it hadn't come down this way. I think it's, we got it right, I think, given the oral arguments and things, but I think it's a tough case, I think, in its application of how it will work. So, sometimes we get predictions right here that, you know, because, you know, we're trying to make educated guesses based on what we're seeing and what we hear and the panels. But sometimes, yeah, you wish that the predictions were wrong. I mean, for our scores, it might take a hit. But sometimes some of these cases that we get right, you wish for a lot of policy reasons that we were wrong.
That's right. Which brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong this week. I think Triplex versus John Donne is reversed, and the circuit court opinions is affirmed.
I think so.
Economic loss plaintiffs is affirmed.
Yep.
And Relentless is reversed in some fashion.
In some fashion. Yeah.
Which brings us to the rule of the week, Dan. Why don't you tee this one up?
Yeah. You found this one. The Seventh Circuit recently agreed to hear an argument en banc before the panel had issued a decision. Pat, tell us about this. And it seemed to be, like you, I haven't found any instance of this, at least in the Seventh Circuit. So why don't you tell us more about this?
So Rule 40 of the circuit rules and FRAP 40, that's Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure, FRAP 40, both allow for en banc to be heard before judgment by the panel. Now, the procedure by which this occurs, I don't know if we know how this happened. It may be that the panel, the judges on the panel looked at this and said, let's just skip the middleman and let's just go right to the en banc panel. And this is how it happened. And then the court as a whole issued an opinion saying, or an order rather, we're going to take this en banc brief, please. And this deals with Rooker-Feldman, so subject matter jurisdiction, because why not? It's in very technical arguments over Rooker-Feldman. I'm not going to get into the details of it because we've been running long as it is. But when I was listening to the argument, Dan, I heard one voice, and then I heard another voice, and then I heard a third voice. I'm like, okay, that's the three judges. And then I heard a fourth voice, and a fifth, and a sixth, and I was like, oh, this is en banc. How the hell did this get en banc? So I looked because I was like, I don't remember this case. And then I went and found the order that they ordered it, you know, before the panel ruling. So I was like, all right, I didn't miss this one. Sometimes you miss things. And I was like, oh, I didn't miss this one. I actually didn't, there was nothing to miss. So very interesting case. If you want to learn about Rooker-Feldman, this is a good place to start. That and an article I wrote many years ago. You can find it online on Rooker-Feldman that I wrote with Alice Sheeran and Jim Sipchin, my former partner. So they'll give you a little primer on that, but it's a very interesting case and an interesting rule that they chose to exercise. The Seventh Circuit doesn't go en banc very often, and for them to have done this way was very unique. So with that, Dan, that's all we have. We'll take our leave and see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel.
Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.